Looks like I never started the voice recording. Well, this podcast is going to start with three principles rather than the long exposition about why we should worry about moral considerations. Equality and fairness. In a just society, all persons would have broadly equal access to the material and social means necessary to live a flourishing life. I explain all that in some detail in the Envisioning Real Utopias. Let me just mention two things. First, equal access. I think that's the right egalitarian principle. The standard egalitarian principle is equal opportunity. That's the way people tend to think about what it means to have an equal society. It's not that everybody is the same, but everybody has the same opportunity. Equal opportunity. That doesn't answer all the questions. It's equal opportunity for what? You know, it could be equal opportunity for welfare. It could be equal opportunity for resources. A lot of different ways of playing out what you're having equal opportunity for. What is the equalizand of equal opportunity, as philosophers say? I think equal access is a better way of thinking about it, and it's a sociologically more informed notion of how human beings actually screw up and take advantage or fail to take advantage of the opportunities they have. Of course, equal access means that you do have opportunities. It's not equal access but no opportunities. It's just a way of thinking that the opportunities in question should be opportunities throughout your life, not just opportunities at the starting gate. Equal opportunity is usually framed as what's called starting gate equality. As long as everybody is on a level playing field and has equal opportunity at the starting gate, that's, I suppose, a horse race metaphor, then whatever inequalities are fine. I think an egalitarian view of the human condition says people should really have equal access to flourish, and you should be able to screw up. You should be able to be a teenager with myopia, make bad choices, squander opportunities, and still not be denied access to the conditions to live a flourishing life. The punishment for being stupid in your choices should not be that for your whole life you languish, that you can't flourish. And equal access to the social and material conditions to live a flourishing life is a way of capturing that egalitarian idea. And what it means to say that in a just society that's true is that if it isn't true, if people don't have equal access to the conditions to flourish, they have a legitimate grounds for complaint. You know, that's even if they made bad choices, they still have a grounds for complaint that they have been denied access to what it takes to flourish. Democracy and freedom. In a fully democratic society, all people would have broadly equal access to what? To the necessary means to participate meaningfully in decisions about things which affect their lives. This is what's sometimes called an effect notion of democracy. What it means to live in a democracy is that things which affect you, you should be able to participate in deciding. That's a very expansive idea and utterly unrealistic. That is, since everything affects everybody in some way or other, it simply doesn't make any sense to say that we don't have a democratic society unless you can participate in every decision that has any effects on you. Now, the implication of that is that, of course, we need to then develop social rules about the line of demarcation between those decisions that we care about that affect other people, and therefore they should be able to participate, and those which we don't care about. We're going to rule them out. They are not subject to this criterion. But that boundary, the boundary between the public and the private, is itself something that needs to be democratically determined. Secondly, this definition of democracy also then makes freedom simply the flip side of democracy. It's two sides of one process. Freedom is simply the realm of decisions over which you don't have to ask anybody's permission. But that boundary over the things... I hope they don't think they have a class in here. Because they're wrong. but that boundary isn't given by nature. That boundary is something which has to be worked out and worked out politically. The boundary between what's public and what's private. Also, the claim that for those things that are within that public space, that is, they are the decisions over which you should be able to participate meaningfully because it affects you in a salient way, that leaves open exactly what is the mechanism of such participation. One mechanism of participation in such decisions, for example, is to participate in setting up government regulations. So if you have firms of whether they be cooperatives or capitalist firms or whatever, that make decisions that affect people in the broader community, not just the consumers. Well, those, and you want to participate in shaping those decisions, one way to do it is by having government regulation over the behavior of firms. It doesn't mean that you have to vote on the board of directors of what the firm does, that you have to choose the management. So there's many different mechanisms. Indeed, consumer choice is a mechanism. One way you can affect the decisions of firms is by purchasing or not purchasing their products. And that counts as affecting the behavior of firms. That counts as participating. And for some things, that may be the best way to do it. You know, the best way to, the best way as a society to deal with the fact that there are companies that produce lousy products and companies that produce good quality products is not to create a rule that forces all companies to produce good quality products. You might have a rule to produce only safe products, but good quality products? No, people can produce lousy products. And the way in which you participate in shaping that decision is by not purchasing. Okay, the voice recording continued. I don't know how to turn off the phone without turning off the
airplane mode.
Oh, airplane mode.
That'll work.
Let's just go to airplane mode. All right, well, I'm going to go to airplane mode. Airplane mode. We are on an airplane. Okay. That's the. That, I have to remember to turn off the airplane mode after the. Okay, community solidarity. Community solidarity expresses the principle that people ought to cooperate with each other not simply because of what they personally get out of it, but also out of a commitment to the well-being of others and a sense of moral obligation that this is the right thing to do. The first of these is the sort of altruistic idea that you want to live in a world in which people really do care about other people's well-being, not just their own. That means that you live in a community of people, where a community can mean your family, it can mean your neighborhood, it can mean your broader community where you live, or in the most expansive sense, the community of humanity. But you cooperate with other people because of a genuine concern for their well-being. That's one aspect of the value of community. And the other is the Kantian principle that you don't want to be a free rider, that you're a scumbag. If cooperation is needed for your own welfare, for your own interests, it's needed, and you want to just be a free rider on other people's cooperation, but not your own. That's a moral side. You don't have to care about other people to be a Kantian. You can still be only concerned about yourself, but you also are concerned about moral principle. So there's a Kantian and a compassion or a altruistic face to the value of community. Okay. I'm going to skip over elaborating further these ideas. There will be times when we will encounter each of these values in different ways, and we'll have a chance to discuss them further. The second task, diagnosis and critique of capitalism. That's what we'll be talking about in the rest of this lecture. And the next is how to understand capitalism as a system and how does the inner dynamics of capitalism generate a critique in light of these values. let me make a few comments about the issue of alternatives. The key problem in studying alternatives in social contexts is trying to understand what the limits of possibility, what it means to have limits of possibility, of social possibility. So it's easy enough if you don't constrain yourself to issues of viability and achievability to come up with fantastically better societies. You know, you can ask any freshman undergraduate, okay, what would be your perfect world? But don't worry about whether it would work, and don't worry about whether we can get from here to there. It's easy to cook up utopias. The problem is to cook up utopias that actually work, would actually work. But here then is the problem. The limits of what's possible in social contexts are not independent of people's beliefs in what is possible. And that's really a crucial issue. What people think is possible is one of the determinants of what's possible. Now, that doesn't follow that simply believing something is possible renders it possible. Of course not. But it's certainly the case that the belief in possibility, the belief in what those limits are, is one of the crucial determinants of what is in fact possible, what those limits in fact are. This is different from the limits of possibility imposed by natural law. You know, the speed of light was a constraint on how fast things could go even before Einstein. But the possibilities of alternatives to capitalism is not independent of our theories of alternatives to capitalism. The theories themselves affect possibility. That's that reflexive, sort of recursive aspect of emancipatory theory. It affects its own possibilities. That's the first point. A second point that's crucial is that alternatives can be either kind of cookbook alternatives that you just think up theoretically without observing the world as it is, but still attentive to whether things are viable. But alternatives also have the character of emerging endogenously within an existing system in ways that prefigure future realities. And that kind of alternative is the alternative that we will be focusing on. Not alternatives to the existing structures of power and domination that we can just sort of philosophically imagine, but rather the alternatives to existing structures that are themselves produced inside of the old social order, so that you get prefigurative forms of an alternative, and then the struggles are to expand the possibility of fully realizing those prefigurative forms. That will be the centerpiece of the very final session of our class on our weekend retreat, when I discuss the big picture problem of actually how would we go about achieving an alternative to capitalism. Finally, let me just mention what I call the evaluation triplet. I've said it already. When we think about alternatives, there are three criteria. They're interconnected but need to be made explicit. You need to defend the desirability of an alternative, the viability of an alternative, and the achievability of an alternative. Now, in that triplet, it's often the case that people place too much emphasis on achievability. That is, they raise it to the foreground. If something isn't achievable, then there's no point in worrying about whether it's desirable or viable. That seems reasonable. If you can't achieve something, why bother discussing it? We don't want pie-in-the-sky discussions. But the problem of foregrounding achievability is that it can preempt creative thinking about alternatives that would be desirable and viable. And demonstrating the viability of an alternative is one of the things that renders it more achievable. So even though ultimately something that is really unachievable might be an interesting intellectual exercise, but not one that we should spend a lot of time on, even though that's in some sense true. To foreground achievability, I think, is a mistake. It's also the case that the problem of achievability turns out to be, of the three, I think in some ways the most difficult. I mean, just think about it. If I asked you, well, what social transformations of the kind of core institutions of American capitalism, what are achievable in the next 5 years? You'd have lots to say. We all would have. But if I said, what do you think is achievable by the year 2100? You know, you can't even get traction on that question because there's too many contingencies. You know, if global warming produces cataclysmic disruptions of globalized capitalism and finally makes people realize that a massively interventionist state is needed, and that opens up a space for saying, okay, if we're going to have a massively interventionist state to deal with this catastrophe, then it needs to be democratically accountable in a very deep way. You know, who knows what's going to contingently open up space, opportunities for really fundamental transformation. The problem with the achievability criterion is that it is only tractable in the short run. It's just really hard to have a credible account of what's achievable 20, 30, 50 years from now. But the prospects of actually building an alternative to capitalism has a long time horizon. There's no way you're going to have a break in the transcendence of capitalism in the rich countries in the next decade. It's just not going to happen. There's no scenario that gives us a transcendence of capitalism in the time frame in which we can sensibly talk about achievability, which means you have to grapple with the connection of viability and achievability in a different way. This, by the way, to foreshadow a theme we'll be discussing later, this was where Marx was incredibly brilliant in attempting a solution to the achievability problem. I mean, he proposed an absolutely brilliant solution, a kind of end run around the problem. What he developed, as we will see later, is a theory of the long-term demise of capitalism. It was a theory that attempted to show why, in the long term, capitalism simply could not reproduce itself because it destroyed its own conditions of possibility. Well, if you have a scientifically adequate account of the future in which you can show that capitalism destroys its own conditions of existence, then you know that some alternative is going to come about. Capitalism cannot endure forever. Some alternative capitalism is going to come about because capitalism becomes ever more fragile and vulnerable because of its own laws of motion. That was Marx's argument. If that is convincing, if you really know that, then the idea that a more egalitarian and democratic alternative is achievable becomes way more credible. It's one of the possible things that could happen. And the question then is being able to mobilize sufficient capacity to bring about that alternative, given that you know that some alternative is going to happen. You don't know when, you don't know the conditions, but you know that capitalism destroys itself. Well, that was an extraordinarily creative solution to this problem. How do you render an account of achievability when the time horizons of struggle are inherently, relatively short? I don't think, however, that the theory has sound scientific foundations. I mean, I think you can work within the Marxist tradition and hold to broad Marxist contours to your theories of society and social change without holding to that particular thesis that Marx developed in his work, especially in Capital. But we'll talk about that later. All right, well, that was my claim to a 20-minute coda to the last lecture. Let's now move on to the topic for today, capitalism. By the way, I don't know if it's what you feel about just barreling through rather than having a break in the middle of this. I mean, sometimes it seems like a break is needed, but my experience is that there's no such thing as a 5-minute break, that if you, you know, if you have a break for people to stretch and whatever, it always ends up being 10 or 12 minutes and takes away more from the class. So I would prefer just to go on, especially on a day when I'm already far behind in what I was hoping to get through. Okay, the anchor, the concept of capitalism. Now, Marxist theory is much more than just a theory of capitalism. You know, historical materialism, the name for, subsequently given for Marx's theory of history, attempts to be a very broad sweeping account of the trajectory of human societal development from the primordial past to the present and even as a projection into the future. So it's a much broader theory than just a theory of capitalism. Nevertheless, I think the theory of capitalism, its dynamics and contradictions, is the centerpiece, the anchor for the whole theory. The only reason Marxists really care about feudalism is because it helps us understand the origins of capitalism. And that great historic transition might give us some clues about the dilemmas of the transition from capitalism beyond. The theory of the emergence of capitalism from feudalism could be completely incorrect. It could be scientifically inadequate. And yet the account of capitalism could be completely sound, because the theory of the origins of capitalism was serving a particular theoretical purpose, to understand the shift from one mode of production to another, just as a way of getting some leverage on the shift from capitalism to its own future. But again, there's no intrinsic reason why that first transition would have anything to do with a later transition. There's no natural law that says all transitions between different fundamental economic structures have to have the same character. So it could be that you get no clues about about the nature of transcending capitalism from the analysis of the transcendence of feudalism. Now, Marx thought you would get clues. That's why he built this bigger theoretical edifice. But the whole purpose of it is to enrich the account of capitalism. That's the world in which we live. That's the world where the oppressions we encounter are produced and reproduced, and that's the world we hope to transcend. And that's why I call capitalism and the study of capitalism the anchor. We will see this repeatedly throughout the semester. When we discuss class in the next block of the course, we'll be concerned with classes in capitalist society. There'll be occasional references to other forms of class relations, feudal class relations, but it's only by way of, only because it helps to give more precision to the account of the specificity of capitalist class relations. In the discussions of the state, we will have some discussion of the contrast between the state in capitalist societies compared to other societies, but the purpose of that is also not to better understand feudalism, because we really care about the internal dynamics of feudalism and how to overcome those forms of oppression. No, it's because the contrast with feudalism helps to give more precision to our capacity to understand capitalism. And the same with ideology. So capitalism is really the center of action. First, then, point here, a note on concepts and definitions. Throughout this course, we will be defining concepts. I talked about this a bit in the last lecture when we had some discussion of the kind of standing of concepts. There'll be many concepts: class, exploitation, forces of production, the state, ideology, mystification. You'll have a whole dictionary by the time you're done with this class. I would say, in a way, in terms of the amount of time we spend on different issues in the class, different styles of analysis, probably the single thing we spend the most time with is dictionarying, you know, giving precision to concepts. I was once accused by Theda Skocpol, a very well-known, important American sociologist, an old friend, in a public discussion about, this is in the early 80s, she accused me of packing my bags for a trip I never take, which was a jibe at my obsession with getting precise definitions of concepts. I mean, the point of getting precise definitions of concepts is to use them in building theories. So the terminology I use is concept formation and theory construction. You form concepts in order to construct theories. And the interesting logic of this is that, of course, the meaning of concepts only comes fully from how they actually function within a theory. You know, a couple of you were in the Theory of the State seminar I'm giving, where I ran through some of this last time, so you will have heard this last week. It's just like learning a language, you know.
I'm sorry, was there a jacket left in here?
Yes, there was. Here is your jacket.
Thank you, sorry about that.
You know, so language, words get their meaning from the sentences in which they function. They don't just get their meaning from sort of their own definition per se. And that's why you can't read dictionaries unless you know a language, right? So there's this magical point when you're learning a language, when you've learned enough words and have enough kind of primitive sentences in your head that you suddenly can look up words in a dictionary to increase your vocabulary. And that's because you know enough of the language in order to locate the meanings of particular words within them. Well, that's going to be true throughout this semester as well. In discussing our concepts, one of the key problems we're going to encounter, and this is going to be a source of tremendous muddle in lots of readings because people don't always pay careful attention to this, and this is the problem of the level of abstraction of a concept and the corresponding level of abstraction of the theory in which that concept functions. Levels of abstraction. It's a very tough idea, the levels of abstraction. And we're going to encounter this many times. So the analogy I give, or the example I give to kind of clarify what we're talking about with levels of abstraction, my favorite has always been a biological example with my dog, Ozzy, which some of you will have, again, heard before. I had a dog, Ozzy, who was a corgi. If you had never seen a dog or my dog and you saw this creature, you'd say, well, what is that? What's this creature? And there are many correct answers to the question, what is this phenomenon that we're observing, this corgi? It's a correct answer to say, this is Ozzy. It's a corgi. It's a dog. It's a canine. It's a mammal. It's an animal. It's a living thing. These are all correct answers to the question, what is that? But they are at different levels of abstraction. And for some questions, one or another of these levels of abstraction is appropriate. And for other questions, it would provide you useless descriptions, be a useless level of abstraction to answer the question. So if you want to answer the question about the proliferation of dog hairs over all the furniture and carpets in our house when we had Ozzy, the correct answer to that question has to do with the particular kind of fur that corgis have in contrast to other dogs. What you would need to do is understand the forms of variation in the fur of this particular kind of creature, dogs, and how some shed and some don't shed. Knowing that Ozzy was a mammal would not be the right level of abstraction to answer that question. There are questions for which that is the right level of abstraction. There are other questions for which it is not. So this is the problem. We live in an economy, we live in a world in which we have all sorts of, which has all sorts of properties. One description of American capitalism is that this is an economy. Another is that it is capitalism, not feudalism. Another is that it is neoliberal capitalism, not organized social democratic capitalism. For some questions, knowing that this is just an economy is useless. It doesn't help you understand the things that matter. For other things, knowing that as capitalist will give you the right answers. And for still others, we need to know what kind of capitalism it is, not just that it's capitalist. These are all just different levels of abstraction. So the way to think about levels of abstraction is that a more abstract category contains within it forms of variation. Specifying those forms of variation defines the lower level of abstraction. Within each type in that lower level of variation, there may be further forms of variation. A systematically well-ordered levels of abstraction gives you nested forms of variation. And the nested forms of variation are relevant to answering different kinds of questions. So, for capitalism, then, there are these two kinds of contrast spaces which we will be playing with at different times. One is mode of production versus other ways of classifying societies, particularly the economies. There's many ways of classifying the economic structure of societies. Mode of production is one way. So part of the contrast space of capitalism is understanding capitalism in contrast to other ways of classifying economic structures. You can classify an economic structure by its dominant technology, industrial versus agrarian versus hunter-gatherer versus the knowledge society, the information society. That's a common way of classifying societies. That's a different, array of concept. It's a different concept that specifies variation, the form of technology, the degree of rationalization of social life, modern versus traditional. That's part of the Weberian way of classifying economic structures. There are more or less rationalized economic structures. The theory of rationalization of economic relations is the core of the Weberian account of how to understand the difference between historically different periods of economic development. You can classify societies for sure by broad cultural complexes, Western versus Eastern. It's kind of crude, but a lot of people do classify societies that way. So mode of production is one way of classifying society in contrast to other ways of classifying society. And if you adopt a mode of production way of classification, then capitalism is contrasted to other ways of organizing an economy. Mode of production is the typical abstract term. That's the most abstract level of analysis that Marxists adopt in understanding the forms of variation of economic structures. I think the term mode of production, it has a certain archaic flavor to it. Because a mode of production isn't just about production. It's really economic structure we're talking about. Because a mode of production mode of production analysis also requires an account of modes of exchange, modes of distribution. It's not just about how production per se is organized. It's about how production and exchange and the other practices of an economic structure are organized. Jerry Cohen uses the term economic structure to describe what mostly people in the Marxist tradition have called mode of production. I'm not going to worry about that distinction, but just to alert you to it. Here capitalism is contrasted in the classical Marxian framework to primitive communism, feudalism, and socialism, and advanced communism, and sometimes with a few other slightly less systematically defined modes of production. The Asiatic mode of production, for example, is sometimes referred to by Marxists, or the tributary mode of production. These are different from feudalism or capitalism. We will, when we discuss the theory of history at the end of the semester, have a little bit of discussion about these types of variations as well. All right, point three. How do Marxists then define capitalism? There are basically two approaches. These aren't really alternatives. You can really meld them together, but you'll find in Marxist discussions of capitalism two different ways in which people kind of get down to business in trying to specify what's distinctive about capitalism that contrasts it with other ways of organizing an economy. One approach emphasizes how capitalism is a distinctive form of market society. This is the approach that gets laid out early in Marx's Capital. And here the contrast is between what is sometimes called simple commodity production and capitalist commodity production. So markets, in all market societies, things are produced for purposes of exchange on the market rather than for direct consumption. That's the big contrast. In a market society, you're producing for other people. You're producing things in order to exchange it on the market. This is in contrast to subsistence production, in which you're producing to meet your own needs or the needs of your family or community, but you're not producing in order to exchange. The word commodity production is the term of art that's used in the Marxian framework. When Marxists talk about commodities, they're not just talking about pork bellies and oil. In standard economics, the term commodity refers to these standardized raw objects that get traded on markets. Marxist, the word commodity just means anything produced for a market. The way in which Marxists have described simple commodity production, the way they kind of represent this symbolically, is to say you begin with a certain quantity of commodities, call that C. You exchange it for money. You sell your stuff on the market. And you use that money to buy more commodities. So you start with commodities and you end with commodities. And what the market transaction does is give you a way of exchanging the apples you produce on your farm for the clothing you wish to purchase. So rather than engaging in a simple barter where you find some clothing merchant who wants apples, you sell your apples to somebody who wants apples, get money for it, and buy clothing with it. That CMC is the formula to describe simple commodity production. Capitalist commodity production has a different logic. You begin with a certain amount of money. Use that to buy commodities, which are inputs into a production process. You transform those commodities through some kind of production process, and then you sell the commodities for money on the market. In capitalist commodity production, the key is that you sell it for more money than you begin. So you begin with M, you buy commodities, you mix them together through some process, sell them back on the market, and lo and behold, you end up with more money than you started with. That is called MCM prime, M prime meaning more money than you began with. Somehow or other, the process of transforming those commodities produced a surplus in money, it produced profits, more than you started with. Now, the process by which the commodities are transformed could be simply moving them from one place to another. This is certainly a transformation. You send ships out to the Spice Islands, you buy spice from producers of spice, you bring them back to Europe and sell them for more than it cost you to transport them. That still is taking money, buying commodities, transforming them through space, which is a transformation process. That's the production process of spice in Europe, is moving spice from one part of the world to another. I myself think that that should be regarded as a production process. It's a mistake to see transportation as something other than part of what it means to produce the commodity spice on the shelf in Europe. Spice on the shelf in Europe is the commodity that people purchase. The only way you get it is by this physical transformation of its location on the planet. That's one way then, by looking at the market logic, CMC versus MCM prime. Second way of thinking about capitalism is to focus on it as a distinctive organization of production in which there are two crucial dimensions: the form of class relations in that form of production, and the nature of the economic coordination. The class relations are the social relations through which the means of production are owned and power is exercised over their use. In capitalism, the means of production are owned by capitalists, and the use of those means of production is controlled by their owners or their surrogates. Means of production, of course, don't themselves produce anything. Somebody has to use them, whether that's the sailors in the ship that move the spice from one place in the world to another, or the workers in a factory. The means of production have to be set in motion by human laboring activity of one sort or another. And this is where the class relations come in. In capitalism, this labor is provided by workers who do not themselves own the means of production, and who, in order to get an income, are hired by capitalist firms to use those means of production. I mean, this, I think, is a pretty conventional way of thinking about it. The fundamental class relation of capitalism, therefore, is the social relation between capitalists who own the means of production and workers who provide labor to be set in motion, to set in motion those means of production. We're going to add a lot of complexity to that simple idea when we get to the study of class. But that's the core. That's the core, a simple binary relationship between owners and laborers. Economic coordination in capitalism is accomplished primarily through mechanisms of decentralized voluntary exchange. Decentralized voluntary exchange by privately contracting parties. This is what's usually called free markets, through which prices and quantities of goods and services are determined. This kind of market coordination is conventionally contrasted with authoritative state coordination, in which coordination is done by command. The commands themselves may be democratically or bureaucratically or despotically organized. But allocations of resources for different purposes are not accomplished through decentralized voluntary exchange by privately contracting parties, but by authoritative allocation. That's the standard contrast to the market that has certainly ideological traction. The metaphor of the invisible hand, which is the sort of standard way that people think about the market, captures this basic idea. Individual firms and individuals, simply pursuing their own private interests, engage in all sorts of voluntary bargaining and exchanges with other individuals and firms. None of that is coordinated by any central authority, and yet out of all of these microeconomic interactions, you get a more or less coordinated economy at the macro level. It's really, of course, quite astounding. You know, it's if anybody who's thought seriously about how even a vaguely coordinated macro structure could come out of utterly decentralized exchanges where nobody is ordering anybody to engage in the macro coordination. Now, it turns out, as we know, that if you literally left it all up to uncoordinated, decentralized voluntary contracts, the system would get completely out of whack, that you need some degree of not just rules, but constraints on the character of those interactions in order to stabilize the macro system. So there are macro problems that have to be attended to. This is what a lot of economics is, or at least some branches of economics are concerned with. Nevertheless, the basic logic of coordination is coming from these decentralized exchanges. Well, that's what capitalism is. It's this combination of an authoritarian set of class relations where there are some owners, there are owners and non-owners, and owners are granted the powers of commanding the labor of non-owners. The non-owners voluntarily enter into that command relationship by agreeing to work for a wage, but the contract, the employment relation, the deal that's struck is one in which property owners have the right to be despots. That's the nature of capitalism. We assign the power of domination to those who own the means of production. And that defines a particular structure of class relations. And then the economic structure gets coordinated through the voluntary transactions between individuals and firms organized in this kind of way. Well, that's just the point of departure. The key issue then for a lot of analysis centers around understanding complexity. Now, this is, I think, a key. I keep using the word key, central, critical. You know, take my adjectives and my constant emphasis of things like that. Take it a little softly. I mean, I might overdo it a bit. In the process of forming concepts and developing them in a coherent way, a really fundamental problem is how do you add complexity? So complexity can be added to concepts in an ad hoc and haphazard way, or you can add complexity in a systematic way. Now this, of course, is the great accomplishment of certain areas of science. When we think of biology, we've got this fantastic array of different creatures in the world and different living things, a bewildering array. And what evolutionary biology has managed to do is to organize all this complexity so we understand really that dogs are a form of complexity, form of variation within a broader category, canines, which are a form of variation within a broader category which we call mammals. It's very systematic addition of complexity. The periodic table of elements in chemistry has enabled us to understand the complexity of compounds, again, in an extremely orderly way. All compounds are forms of combination of the elements in the periodic table. Fantastic achievement. Every single compound that has ever existed on the Earth, anywhere in this universe as far as we know, is a simple form of combination of the 100 or so elements in the periodic table. And the periodic table itself is a systematic organization of complexity of protons, neutrons, electrons, and all that. It's an amazing achievement. Well, in a much less amazing way, there's an attempt to figure out the complexity of economic systems and the complexity of capitalism in a more orderly way, rather than just seeing, you know, every difference as itself of equal standing. There are two primary ways, I think, that in the Marxian tradition, complexity is added to this root concept of capitalism. First is the idea that capitalism is mixed with a variety of non-capitalist forms in any society. There's no society, no economy, which could ever be pure capitalism. So pure capitalism is what I think methodologists call an ideal type. Marx didn't use that term, but that's the appropriate term. Pure capitalism is like a frictionless plane in physics. A frictionless plane is a very useful idea because it helps you to give a set of formulas for how things move, how gravity would affect something on a plane, all sorts of things, even though we know all planes have friction. What the frictionless plane also helps you do is understand the effects on bodies in motion when you add friction of varying degrees. the frictionless plane is the limiting case then. Well, pure capitalism was the kind of limiting case of any economic structure. There could be no structure that was exclusively capitalist. And one way in which actual economic structures are complicated is because of the ways they combine capitalist and non-capitalist forms of production. My own work on transcending capitalism is grounded in that insight. That is, the way to think about going beyond capitalism is to identify the more emancipatory alternatives that exist within capitalism itself, within capitalist economies. That is, within economies that are themselves dominated by capitalism, and then to figure out ways of expanding the space for these non-capitalist forms. All actual economic systems contain capitalist and non-capitalist forms, and a lot of what differentiates one kind of capitalism from one kind of society from another, one kind of economic structure from another, in the capitalist world is the particular mix. When you go to less developed countries, particularly the most underdeveloped, you're struck by how much non-capitalist economic activity there is. When you're in the United States, of course, capitalism is way more dominant. Nearly everything you purchase in the market has been produced in a capitalist way and purchased through a capitalist firm. Nearly everything, not everything, but most things. But even in American capitalism, we have some non-capitalist forms that are quite striking. The farmer's market in Madison on Saturdays during the summer is predominantly a market for the selling of produce that's been produced in non-capitalist ways. There's some agribusiness, I suppose, that sells stuff on the farmer's market, but mostly it's family farms. And a family farm is a very different kind of enterprise than a capitalist farm. It's true that family farms often will have some hired hands, but it's still a very different kind of production relation. Okay, that's one form of complexity. Capitalism is mixed with various non-capitalist forms. But also there are very many different types of capitalism. And giving systematic character to the different types of capitalism is another important theoretical task. You can think of many, many things on that list.
Can you just give an example of what makes that farmer's market less capitalist?
Well, because the production relations under which much of the produce has been produced is primarily family labor. So they are simple, they're commodity producers, so they are producing for a market, but they're not primarily producing it by hiring labor to set in motion the means of production. Now, of course, a lot of family farms do have some hired hands, but it's really quite different from a regular capitalist firm. And particularly at the Madison farmer market. When you see the Hmong farmers, the intensive vegetable farmers, the Hmong farmers just overwhelmingly are using family labor to produce the vegetables that get sold at the farmer's market. Community-supported agriculture. Many of the community-supported agriculture farms are also much more like simple commodity producers producing for the market rather than capitalist firms. We have a winter share in Snug Haven Farms spinach. So there's a hoop house spinach grower that has a CSA for winter spinach. And winter spinach is a completely different, it's the same species, I'm sure, as spinach, but it's an amazingly different vegetable. Because they've got these huge leaves and they're sweet because they're touched by frost, as the Snug Haven Farm says. Yeah.
What differentiates family labor with normal labor is that the family owns the means of production collectively.
Yeah, and the labor isn't paid a wage. They don't sell their labor. They may get paid a stipend. The people may give their kids and other family members an allowance, but they're not exchanging their labor power for a wage in order to set the means of production in motion. So it's much more like a community producing collectively for their own collective welfare, and then selling the surplus on a market. And that's a really different kind of social relation. There isn't a class relation involved. You know, it's not that children don't sometimes feel dominated by their parents on a family farm. They have
democratic run.
And it'll vary. You know, it's not democratic in the sense of you have a workers' assembly that votes for the manager. But, you know, family farms have an awful lot of give and take and discussion and, you know, working things out. It's just a whole different process by which chores get allocated, even though you can have a despotic, patriarchal family farm, too. But still, that's a different kind of relationship than a class relation. But there's also variation within capitalism, different kinds of capitalism. So, for example, capitalisms vary tremendously in the degree and form of regulation. And some of these degrees and forms of regulation really do represent an erosion of private property rights. When you have a highly regulated capitalism where, for example, occupational safety and health rules are strictly enforced, where product safety is strictly enforced, where food labeling rules are strictly enforced, where all these things are strictly enforced, what you're saying is that the owners do not have the right to use their means of production in certain ways. They can't hire workers under whatever voluntary agreement they could get. They are restricted in their exercise of their private property rights. There's been a partial socialization of property rights when certain rights which one might think come with owning something are taken away from you. So highly regulated versus less regulated capitalism is one of the forms of variation. This gets, the terms that get used for this vary. Some theorists talk about regimes of accumulation as describing the forms of variation of how capital is regulated. In the 1980s, there was a fashionable distinction, organized versus disorganized capitalism. That was one of the ways one would specify the forms of variation of capitalism. The degree of competitiveness. You can have a capitalism that's made overwhelmingly of small firms that compete with each other, or a capitalism dominated by giant corporations. And sometimes it's a little hard to see. I mean, the United States, if you count the number of firms, you know, 90% of all firms in the United States, I don't know the exact figures, but I think 90% of the firms in the United States have less than 10 employees. So it looks like we have an economy that's made up massively of small firms. But they are clearly dominated by very large corporations. And many of these small firms are not actually autonomous firms. They're franchises of big firms. And although they're independently owned franchises, they're strictly controlled by the franchising corporation. You can have globalized capitalism versus nationally contained capitalism. That's one of the striking features of the last 30 or 40 years has been the extent of global integration of national economic structures. You can have service-centered capitalism, information-based capitalism. We're sometimes described as, you know, the information age, where we have a knowledge-based capitalism rather than an industrial-based capitalism. The degree of financialization. What role do strictly finance institutions play in the overall capitalist economy? And so on. There's lots of forms of variation, and that's another way of adding complexity. All right, well, that's the basic kind of conceptual space. Capitalism is private ownership, particular class relations coordinated through markets. It's combined with other kinds of economic structures to form one type of complexity, capitalism and non-capitalist relations combined in an economy, and capitalism itself has all sorts of dimensions of variation. So far, we're just working on the conceptual space. Now let's turn to point four, the core dynamics of capitalism. The heart of the theory of capitalism is an account of the dynamic forces in play in capitalism, or what Marx called the laws of motion. This is where you move from simply a concept of capitalism to a theory of capitalism. It's a theory about the processes that are set in motion when you have an economic structure of this form. So the Marxian claim is, to say it in its strongest form, if anywhere in the universe you happen to get an economic structure with the properties described as capitalist, this will set in motion a set of dynamics. You will observe these dynamics. If you don't observe these dynamics, then something must be countering them. Right? So it's a real predictive theory. It's a strongly predictive theory. It says, what should you expect to happen when you have class relations of this character coordinated in this manner? Get capital-labor relations coordinated through markets. What's going to happen when you have that? What kind of process and dynamics will get set in motion? And you really, that it's a deterministic theory, I mean, in the sense that it's saying, damn, if we didn't see these dynamics and you had that structure, something must be going on. And if you can't figure it out, then it would call into question the theory, because the theory really says these are the dynamics that get set in motion when you have that structure. In many ways, the crucial elements of the Marxian argument are fully accepted by neoclassical economists. It's not, I mean, there are places where they're sharply opposed to each other, but some aspects of these foundational dynamics are not by any means unique to the Marxist tradition itself. All right, so the first dynamic that gets set in motion is capitalist competition. Each firm, in order to survive over time, must compete successfully with other firms. Competition should not mainly be thought about as the motivation of individual capitalist firms, but as a pressure they experience in order to stay in business. The Marxian idea is not primarily that capitalists are greedy in their motivations and seek profits in order to enrich themselves. Not that Marxists and Marx himself would deny that those motivations are present in capitalism, but those motivations, if anything, are the consequence of the character of the relations in which people find themselves. That in order to survive, businesses have to adopt strategies which look like you're trying to maximize profits, and a set of personal motivations in which you also want to enrich yourself in the process helps to reinforce that dynamic. But the dynamic is generated by the competition. There are two broad strategies that firms adopt in competition. There are many subtypes of this, but if you want to kind of strip it all down to the bare minimum, if you're competing with other firms in order to survive, there are two sorts of things you can do. One is you can lower the cost of production and increase your productivity. You can do this by lowering wages sometimes. You can do it by innovating in the process of production, sometimes by new technologies. There's all sorts of ways that firms compete with each other by attempting to lower the costs of production so that the things which they sell will be more attractive to the people who buy them. So that's one strategy of competition. Second way to compete is by producing new things, figuring out how to sell new things or to sell them in new places, expanding markets either by producing new things that in which there aren't competitors or by finding new places to sell them. The relentless drive for profit that is caused by these two mechanisms of competition, by reducing costs and expanding markets, is a central factor that generates the striking dynamism of capitalism relative to earlier forms of economic organization. This is a view that Marx certainly held, and it's a view that I think is broadly held by most non-Marxist analysts of capitalism. Okay, that's one source of dynamism. Now, there's another source of dynamism that Marxists focus on, but which is not usually present in non-Marxist analysis. And that is that class conflict itself is a source of dynamism of capitalism. Class conflict itself is a source of dynamism. We'll see this more clearly when we engage the problem of exploitation. Is that, say, 12? No, quarter to the glare. Okay, all right, we're not doing too badly. When we discuss exploitation in a couple of weeks, or maybe even, might even be next week, I don't remember exactly where it is on the schedule, the way in which exploitation generates dynamics, not just conflict, will become clearer. Capitalists always face a problem of extracting effort from workers, getting workers to work hard and to work productively. It's a perpetual and intrinsic problem in capitalist class relations. You hire people who have no stake in the enterprise. They're just selling you their labor power. The level of effort that they want to expend and the level of effort that you want them to expend are different. Sam Bowles and Herb Gintis referred to the level of effort of the that workers want to expend as the whistle while you work level of effort, an allusion to Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Yeah, the Seven Dwarfs loved to work, and when they went off to the mines with their pickaxes, they would whistle while you work, and that was a famous song from the from the animated film Snow White, Seven Dwarfs. So that's the whistle while you work level of effort. And the whistle while you work level of effort is generally less than the desirable level of effort that capitalists have. And so they have to do something about it. They have to expend resources to get workers to work harder than workers want to work themselves. And that generates the central tension at the point of production. This problem is intensified when workers organize for collective resistance. It's present even when there are no unions, when there's no collective mobilization. It's always a problem, but it's intensified when collective action occurs. And this then generates internal pressures on the capitalist firm to innovate in ways which make them less dependent on the effort of their workers. A part of the motivation for automation is not just that automated production is itself intrinsically more productive, but robots don't resist. You can control the level of effort of robots more effectively than you can control the level of effort of workers. Yeah?
I just have a question. When you go back to the emancipatory, how can you possibly account for all the complex relationships within capitalism that would make somebody want to sort of believe in that type of transfer? I mean, I can see that poses a great complication to people, sort of the ability to go far enough to explain all of, when you propose a transformation, to be able to go far enough to explain all the implications of that is extremely difficult.
Well, so workers experience domination directly. They experience a whole array of harms from capitalism. So the first step in any effort at kind of ideological struggle around this, we'll discuss this when we get to the ideology session, but just to foreshadow it, the first step is getting people to accept the diagnosis and critique of the source of harms which they experience in their life. And the second step is to make credible the idea that there is an alternative. You know, so people experience all sorts of harms in life and they say that's just life. And some of it is just life. You know, many forms of human suffering occur because of the human condition and not because of social institutions that could be altered. So the first task is to get people to understand the sources of their own suffering, of the harms. That is what's typically thought of as consciousness raising. In the women's movement, consciousness raising was really primarily about that. It was to understand that the forms of unhappiness and suffering and oppression that people experienced were not just the result of the natural order of things, but were the result of the particular kinds of social relations in which they lived, and therefore could in principle be resisted or transformed. But, and that's why the diagnosis and critique plays such a big role. But it's and in some contexts that does most of the work, because once you get people to identify the harms, they see the target that they need to resist, and they can effectively resist it. But in the case of capitalism, you also need an understanding of an alternative and a capacity to struggle for that alternative. That's why political parties and unions have always played such a crucial role in making possible not just be identifying what's wrong in the world as it is, but doing something about it. So I think there's that kind of two-step process. Okay. The dynamics are generated by competition and are generated by class conflict. Now, here then is the kind of key idea that I think does differentiate Marxists from non-Marxist accounts of these dynamics. I mean, first of all, the non-Marxist accounts tend to minimize class conflict itself as a source of dynamics, that is, as one of the pressures that pushes capitalism in a particular way towards certain kinds of innovations. But secondly, most non-Marxist accounts don't really develop a notion of contradiction. And this is the most distinctive feature of the kind of Marxian approach to capitalism, is that capitalism is not merely dynamic, but it is inherently contradictory. So here's another big word, contradiction, used all the time, used casually, used technically. Sometimes the term contradiction gets embedded in what is thought of as a Hegelian discourse. Marx borrowed the term contradiction from Hegel. Some people say that Marx just turned Hegel on his head, that it's just a materialist version of Hegel's idealism. I'm not a Hegel scholar. I've always been a bit skeptical of that mechanical view as to what happens when you borrow the concept and then you use it in a different way. I don't think it's just an inversion of the earlier idea. The kind of Hegelian-ish idea of contradiction is that in human history there are certain forms of practice or ideas, call it a thesis, that generates its opposite, an antithesis, and out of the confrontation between a thesis and an antithesis comes a synthesis. You know, there's a kind of, and thus an evolution, because the new synthesis itself produces an antithesis, which then generates a new synthesis. So you get this kind of back and forth dialectical opposition of forces, which generates outcomes, which generates new oppositions of forces. That's a kind of mechanical reading of an unfolding of a logic of development through successive polarizations and their syntheses, which generate new polarizations. Well, that's one way of thinking about contradiction. That's not the way I use the term. And I don't think it's the most productive way of thinking about what we're even talking about with contradiction as a general idea. I think there are two primary definitions of contradiction. These aren't alternatives. They both exist side by side. They sometimes have very close relations. That does a lot of really good work in explaining things. First, there are chains of effects of a given process which disrupt the functioning of that process. So you have a process with all of its dynamics, and it generates a series of consequences, but those consequences undermine the process itself, disrupts it. Disrupting doesn't mean that the resolution of the disruption somehow pushes the system to a higher level along some trajectory. That's an additional claim. So it's an additional claim that the nature of that disruption is such that the only resolution of the disruption is to move the system to a, quote, higher level. Higher level would mean that you have a developmental trajectory. That can happen, but it's not, I think, a necessary implication of the idea that you can have chains of effects set in motion by a process which disrupt a process. That is at the very heart, I think, of Marx's notion of what's so deeply contradictory about capitalism. So we'll return to this towards the end of the semester when we look at the sort of theory of capitalist development and its contradictions. But Marx believed, for example, that one of the intrinsic effects that get set in motion by capitalism is a tendency for the capital intensity of production to increase. Because that is a result of both trying to successfully compete with your rivals and disciplining labor. Capital intensity makes it easier to discipline labor, that you rely less on the labor effort of individual workers. But increasing capital intensity, Marx argued, because of competition, ultimately undermines the rate of profit, which destabilizes capitalism. So that's a good example. A chain of effects generated by capitalism, increasing capital intensity, undermines the profitability of capitalism. So that's one idea of contradiction. A second idea of contradiction, which we will discuss in detail when we get to the theory of the state part of the course, is that for capitalism, it's such a complex system with all of these moving parts, for it to be stable requires a state that intervenes in various ways to stabilize it. It has to legitimate the system to workers. It has to deal with the money supply. It has to discipline monopolists so that they don't disrupt competition and so on. There's all sorts of functional requirements needed to have a nice and smooth, stable functioning capitalism. The problem is that these different functional requirements contradict each other. You can't do them all. To do one well makes it harder to do another one well. So that the functional requirements of the system are not coherent. They're inconsistent. And that will lead to disequilibria, pendulum swings, policies that contradict other requirements of the system, and so on. That it is impossible to have a state that smoothly reproduces capitalism because smooth reproduction isn't possible. Too many inconsistent requirements for its stable reproduction. I think both of these are important, and both of these are things which we will return to periodically in the course of the semester. All right. Well, I think we are out of time. I'm at 4.3. That's further along this agenda than we were last time. So on Wednesday, I'll finish this up, and then we'll turn to the critique of capitalism as a kind of first approximation. So this is all just sort of stage setting for much of the rest of the course, but I think it will be sufficient for the present purposes.